I'd like to call to order this February 15, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Welcome, everyone, for coming to this morning's hearing. We have on the agenda the work session on House Bill 2787 scheduled first, but we're going to wait a half hour before we do that, if you'll indulge us, and first go into our informational hearing on the Oregon University System, State Board of Higher Education, and our chance to meet our new acting chancellor, Melody Rose. So with that, I'm going to open an informational hearing on Oregon University System and State Board of Higher Ed. I'd like to start off with Chancellor Rose and Vice Chancellor Kenton. You want to come up? Thank you. This is, audience, yet another day in our mini course on Higher Education 101. And today we are looking at that that esteemed jigsaw puzzle called OUS. All right, Chancellor Rose.
Good morning, Chair Dembrow and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Melody Rose, and I was just appointed as interim chancellor of the Oregon University System, and will begin that job on March 2nd. In the meantime, I'm speaking to you today in my current role as Vice Chancellor of Academic Strategies for the University System. I would like to give you a brief introduction of my background, if I may, if you'll indulge me, because I don't know most of you, and I won't spend long on this, but I'd like to share that I spent 17 years as a professor of political science at Portland State University, and I've spent my entire professional life dedicated to the betterment of higher education outcomes for Oregonians. I myself was a low-income, first-generation college student, and I know very personally the incredible potential of public universities to change lives. Had my home state not invested in me as a young student, I would not be here with you today testifying. That investment in me made the person that I am today, and I am forever indebted and motivated to ensure that we can afford the same opportunities for students here in Oregon. It's a very exciting time in higher education here in Oregon. As the governor and our own board president, Matt Donegan, have said, we have a real opportunity in this state to help move the needle on student success by focusing on the outcomes that help students progress through the education continuum most effectively. Our North Star, the 40-40-20 goal, guides us in everything we do at the system because it is so important that we provide all of Oregon students with the opportunity to attain their American dream of education, a good job, community engagement, and a future in the state that we all love. This morning, I'm going to provide just a very brief overview for you of what the System Office does to contribute to higher education success for all students. Some of this falls in the category of not very flashy, but what we do is the operations and the academic glue, if you will, between the seven universities that addresses both the barriers and the gateway to student success. It is our proximity to the classroom, to students, faculty, and learning that allows us to achieve these results. On most of you, your computers at home or in your office here in the building, there's an icon we're all familiar with. It says Intel inside. The computer itself may be a Dell or a Gateway or an Apple, but many of them have the Intel inside logo. That's because the computer, very sophisticated in its own right, can't be fully effective without the chip that pulls all of the technology together and makes it operate. That's what the System Office does. We're not the beautiful campus with the wonderful students and engaged communities at every turn. We're just the chip inside. It's not visible, but it's making everything work for you better, cheaper, faster, and more accountable. And it makes sure that as a state, we're united in meeting all student needs. Because not one institution alone can lift this heavy ball. It takes all of us and all of you to put the public in public university system and to ensure that we're moving forward collectively towards our goals. In short, the Chancellor's office work includes innovating, saving money, and collaborating, all for the benefit of students and accountable to the people of Oregon. We have left you with a handout that summarizes all of the aspects of our job, but I want to share with you a few key examples that are important to me. About 7 years ago, it wasn't easy, as many of you, especially Chair Dembro, know, for community college students to transfer into universities as it is today. Some OUS campuses accepted certain community college credits, and some did not. Some OUS campuses gave full credit for courses taken in high school dual credit, and some did not. Classes weren't numbered in the same way from community colleges to OUS. So biology 205 at a community college only counted as biology 101 at one of our universities. That may seem like a simple barrier to us now, but speaking as a first generation college student myself, I can assure you that that lack of clarity would have made it impossible for me to navigate the system. An initiative developed by the Chancellor's Office and guided by the State Board of Higher Education changed all of that in a very substantial way. We named the initiative More, Better, Faster, and it was and remains all of those things. Now the Oregon Transfer Module allows for a full year of freshman general education courses to transfer between any of the 27 colleges and universities in Oregon with no credit loss, no extra money paid for additional classes, no additional student debt. Associate transfer degrees are also offered at our partner community colleges, easing credit transfer, guaranteeing admission, and enabling students to start as juniors at our universities. All of these aspects of transfer in Oregon make it easier for students to stay in and get through college. It's no coincidence that some years ago, 20% of our students were transfer students, and today we're at 45%. That was not an accident. Innovation in higher education is happening so fast, and this is a great passion for me in the work I currently do as Vice Chancellor of Academic Strategies. It's important that we work collectively so we can take advantage of technology, programs, and philanthropy to get the right innovations into the classroom quickly and effectively. As an example, some of you have heard the term MOOCs, which stands for Massively Open Online Courses. In the System Office, we're engaged in Oregon and nationally on teaching and learning innovations that affect not only our students in the OUS, but also community college and K-12 students. We've been convening a group of faculty from all seven campuses this year to consider MOOCs and other sources of learning that can contribute to a system of credit for prior learning in order to reduce cost and time to degree. This power to convene our faculty around critical education issues leads to better results for students. I also recently engaged a contract with the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, known as our chair knows and others too, known as WICHE, to benefit all seven campuses and all of our students. By engaging in WICHE's Internet Course Exchange Program, all seven campuses can now buy or sell seat or course availability in the Western States market. By purchasing this membership through the system, we saved campuses money. And campuses can now sell excess seats to other states, generating revenues, or purchase seats for their students in subjects where they don't have sufficient faculty or enough local demand to run whole courses. In our changing landscape and need for a highly skilled workforce, it's also important to recognize the skills and experiences of some of our students as they come into our universities. Thus, we're working on the Credit for Prior Learning Task Force to determine the best way to give credit where credit is due, including student veterans who have served our country in the military and other returning and adult students. One more example, if I may, of how the System Office harnesses the strengths of the campuses is the Life Sciences Collaborative, currently under construction in the South Waterfront area of Portland. The idea of a collaborative space where teaching, learning, research, and entrepreneurship could coexist between and among OUS campuses, OHSU, and the private sector came from my colleague and our Vice Chancellor, Jay Kenton. Jay shopped the idea around, generated interest, talked to potential donors about it, ran it by all of you, by the state board and the campuses, and the idea germinated into a new and innovative collaboration. Why not bring together multiple campuses, institutes, and programs and have them share a highly sophisticated academic and research space that alone none of them could afford or pull together? Once the collaborative took off, the Chancellor's Office stepped back and allowed the campuses to do what they do best, teaching and research and discovery. If you haven't had a tour of this incredible facility, I would urge you to do so at your nearest opportunity. So there is also an important convening role that the Chancellor's Office takes as a way to move together as a system to implement strategies and programs. We bring together monthly our presidents, provosts, vice presidents, and other critical groups so we can develop consistent statewide approaches where meaningful to the many student-related and university issues that we all care deeply about. We have also brought together the entire state and all of the education sectors at convenings to address our many education issues, such as the 40-40-20 goal, barriers to student achievement, best practices in student support and retention, and one that we're working on now, which will be of keen interest to the committee, which is a fall convening on student affordability and student loan debt. That's probably enough of an overview for this morning. Thank you very much for your time and attention, and I'll let my colleague Jay Kenton take over unless you all have questions. Thank you, Chair Dembrough.
Thank you. Why don't we hear briefly from Jay, and then we may have questions for both of you. Jay, proceed. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Representative Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jay Kenton, and I'm Vice Chancellor for Finance for the Oregon University System. Since many of you also do not know me, I'm going to just give you a brief summary of my history. I started in higher education finance in 1983 at Eastern Oregon State College, currently known as Eastern Oregon University. I worked there 3 years in the business office and was recruited by Oregon Institute of Technology, where I went and spent another 3 years in the finance office before I was recruited by Portland State University to come to the big city in 1988. I spent 18 years working at Portland State. I started as a director of business affairs and worked my way up through the vice president for finance. After that time, I came to the U.S. Chancellor's Office in 2005 in my current position. In addition to my administrative duties, I also hold the rank of Professor of Public Administration in the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University, where I teach a required class in public administration. I also have taught in the School of Ed at PSU in the College Student Service Program at Oregon State, and I also advise numerous doctoral students at multiple universities. I don't get paid extra to teach. I do it out of passion and as a means of leaving a legacy through my students. As you can imagine, I've seen a great deal of change over my career. I've had good days, and I've had bad days during this time. But the thing that's kept me energized and engaged all the time is helping students succeed. I would like to start this morning by thanking you for your support last session. The passage of Senate Bill 242 was a monumental action that is changing the management philosophy of OUS and its member institutions. The Act provides OUS with greater control over its affairs and provides the flexibility needed to efficiently and effectively manage the administrative and financial operations of the system. This Act provided OUS with greater control over its legal, risk management, human resources, tuition setting, treasury management, and budgetary processes. I would be happy to elaborate about these improvements in more detail at a later date, but suffice it to say, we appreciate the confidence you have placed in us and promise that you will not be disappointed in our outcomes. I would also like to thank you for passing the 40-40-20 goals for Oregon. As I mentioned earlier, this goal now serves as our North Star. I would not have spent my career in this field if I didn't believe in the power that education has in allowing individuals to break the mold that society has cast for them. It is what has gotten me out of bed each and every day for the last 30 years, and it is critically important to the future of this state and its citizenry. Today, I was asked to speak briefly about cost drivers for higher education. As time is short, let me simply leave you with a couple of thoughts, and hopefully I'll have the opportunity to come back when you have more time to elaborate on these thoughts. First, when I think about costs, and by the way, you have, I believe, a PowerPoint or a presentation in your packets that I may be referring to here, or I will be referring to. When I think about costs, I think about cost to whom? And I think the first and primary concern is cost to students. And student costs obviously come in the form of tuition and fees. Since the passage of Ballot Measure 5 in 1990, tuition has risen by an average of 6% per year over the last 20 years. This has resulted in average tuition, and not including fees, growing from $1,800 in 1993 to $6,300 in 2011. During this same time, we've seen state support per resident student drop from $5,200 in 1990 to approximately $4,000 today, and that is in non-inflation adjusted dollars. If you combine these two amounts, tuition and state support, and adjust them for inflation, it means that today OUS is receiving 18% less in nominal funding per student today than it did in 1990. And our costs have grown, and in some cases, significantly. Secondly, if you turn to costs to the institutions, as I just noted, costs have increased. Yet while many of our costs have grown at rates significantly greater than inflation, our average instructional costs of serving students have only risen slightly more than inflation since 1996. This is a tribute to our dedicated faculty and staff employees who have found ways to improve productivity and who now serve more students, generate more research, and offer more services than at any time in our history. As you can imagine, OUS costs are largely comprised of personnel-related costs. In fact, in our Education in General Fund operations, and that fund, by the way, is funded with state appropriation, tuition, and like indirect cost recoveries and grants, it's our primary operating fund. Personnel costs comprise 78% of the total cost in that operating fund. Obviously, the numbers and types of faculty and staff drive costs, but it also drives quality. Today, 35% of our faculty are part-time, compared to 20% in 1996. Part-time faculty are more specialized and generally cost less due to lesser benefits. In addition, student-to-faculty ratios have increased, and OUS faculty salaries lag peers. These are troubling trends as our campuses struggle to recruit and retain a quality faculty in appropriate numbers with a sustainable mix of full-time and part-time faculty. Employee benefits is also an area of concern. Last year alone, due to the unfunded pension obligations, retirement costs grew by $45 million, and health care costs continue to grow at rates between 5 to 10% per year, adding $10 to $20 million each year in additional costs. In the last 10 years, due to both growth and greater numbers of employees, these costs have grown from $160 million to $350 million, and there's a chart in your packet that shows that. And due to reductions in state funding, these costs are being borne in greater proportion by tuition. Tuition that continues to grow at unacceptable rates to you, to our students and their families, and to our OUS institutions. It is for these cost reasons alone that we hope you will support the governor's proposals to reform the PERS program and restructure how health care is delivered in the state. These are difficult decisions, yet decisions that must be made to ensure our costs remained under control, so our tuition remains affordable, so we can achieve the state's 40-40-20 educational goals. That's probably enough for today. As I mentioned earlier, I would be happy to come back at your convenience and discuss this with you in more detail. Thank you for your support and for all you're doing to make Oregon a better place. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jay. We do look forward to a further conversation around that. But and there may be questions, but before we do that, I'd like to call up Matt Donegan, if we could. Pleasure to call up Matt Donegan, who's the chair of the State Board of Higher Ed. And my comrade through many difficult meetings around governance, together with Rep. Johnson over the last year.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to join you here this morning. I've been asked to describe what the State Board of Higher Education does. And in doing so, what I'm going to try to do is focus on really what I see as being the unique value proposition. And by unique value proposition, what I mean is really what is it the State Board does that others don't do. And I guess there's three concepts that I would just introduce. The first concept is it is a citizen board that is populated by volunteers like myself. And the key concept there is to provide citizen oversight over the universities. The second distinction would be staff versus board. The board really does try to focus as best it can on strategy and not micromanaging operations. It's tempting because the operations are really where a lot of the fun occurs. And so we have to try to exercise some discipline to stay out of the operational matters and focus on strategic matters, which are often a lot less sexy. And the third concept that I'll really expand upon, because I think it really does speak to the unique value proposition, is just central versus decentralized services. And I would just say, you know, my own philosophy coming from the private sector is if a function can be decentralized, that's usually the best place for it to reside. I mean, that's really where the expertise resides. It's really where the action occurs, in this case, in the classrooms, in the research facilities, in the laboratories. And so the general philosophy that I bring, and I think it's also fairly well upheld by the university system, is that really if a function can be decentralized, that's the best place for it to be. So that really leaves us and the State Board and also with the Chancellor's Office and OUS really trying to focus on the unique areas where non-campus activities should occur. So really that's how I tend to frame things up is what are the non-campus activities that really only we can provide. And there I'll organize my comments around four broad areas. And these will, in a form follows function, these will actually be outlined by the committee structure because our committees then actually carry out these functions. And so there's four broad areas I'll speak to. The first one is academic strategies. Here the main goals, as you might imagine, are first of all to make sure that our public universities maintain their public mission. And so that generally means serving resident Oregonians. So as we really put everything together across our seven universities, when we add them all up, are we fulfilling that most core basic mission? Are we serving resident Oregonians? Number two, are we serving all Oregonians? So are we providing access? Are we ensuring diversity? Are we serving rural Oregonians? Are we serving the geographies well? Number three, are we providing economic development? Are we providing, are our academic strategies really linked to industry and Oregon's economy? And so really when you put those goals together in terms of actual deliverables, the main thing that we provide is program approval, mission approval, to ensure that when you look across all seven universities, that we're providing the programs that our students need to succeed, and also that we're not providing undue competition, particularly for costly programs like engineering, like medicine, so that we're not providing three or four of these types of programs that the state, a small state like ours, just simply can't. So this is a big part of the drumbeat within the academic strategies function within the Board of Higher Ed on an ongoing basis. But more recently, We have now, this same function has expanded to really look at a long-term 40-40-20 strategy as the state really embraces that goal. And so Dr. Rose has personally led this effort within OUS, and we're really trying to look at a 15-year plan is how do we achieve our 12-13-year plan, how do we get to 40-40-20. So that's the first big function is academic strategies. The second big function is finance and administration. Here, the first major goal is fiscal stewardship, to make sure that we as a board are providing fiscal oversight for the universities and that they are financially sustainable. So we have, with Jay's leadership, tremendous amount of oversight on a quarterly basis, at least, if not more frequently, to look at, make sure that the schools are fiscally sustainable. And then also, second, making sure that the students are being treated fairly with regard to tuition setting. The third broad area is governance and policy. Here I like to think about two functions, two core deliverables. One is maintaining the state's human capital. The major two sources of human capital are the university presence as well as the chancellor's office leadership. So the board provides direct oversight in terms of hiring and firing, performance evaluations to make sure our human capital remains intact. The second major function here is also just workflow, to make sure, you know, as you look across the universities, the seven, do we have the right structures in place? And it was that kind of an analysis that really led to our advocacy in Senate Bill 242 that tried to seek some greater autonomy, some greater flexibility, because we saw a lot of opportunities as you look across the university system that for value to accrue back to our students. And then the fourth major area is external relations. And, you know, when it comes to higher education, post-secondary education, a lot of opinions out there, a lot of views out there. And what we try to provide is strategic messaging to engage the public, to advocate on behalf of higher education, to explain the importance of higher education to Oregon's future, but also have a two-way dialogue so that we're understanding the positions of Oregon and we can evolve. So those are the four basic areas, and again, you know, what I would leave you with is that we try to focus on non-campus activities, and as we consider reform, as the legislature considers reform, you know, I think these functions should survive where they get positioned locally versus central, to be determined, but I don't see any proposals that would eliminate these core functions, but perhaps reoptimize them.
Thank you, Mr. Donegan. Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jay, this is going to be for you, and it has to do with student tuition. Your name came up in testimony Wednesday, and so we're going to be making a very difficult decision, or some people at the dais think that's going to be a very difficult decision on House Bill 2787 here shortly. And since your name came up and you're here, maybe in the wrong place at the wrong time, I wanted to ask you a question. You were talking about student tuition, and then Matt mentioned fairness in tuition. And in regards to in-state tuition, regardless of your color, you come to an Oregon university to pay in-state tuition. Is that tuition subsidized? Does in-state tuition cover the cost for that student? And I know it's a tough question because you have multiple funding streams. You have a little bit of input from the state general lottery fund. You have input from alumni. You have input from the feds. I get that. But I'm trying to get to, are we putting a burden on the Oregon taxpayer, or are we putting a burden on other students? You mentioned several times about trying to keep costs down, but student tuition increases, whether that's in-state or other tuition. Can you clarify a bit for me?
I'd be happy to. Chair Dembrough, Representative Huffman. In my larger presentation, which I had prepared in anticipation of at some point talking to you about that, I would tell you, our average costs run probably in the $12,000 to $13,000 per student range. Average costs across all students. I don't have an average cost by undergrad versus grad, but that's across all, grad, undergrad, res, non-res, et cetera, just average costs in all disciplines. Some disciplines are more expensive than others, as you can imagine, engineering compared to, say, sociology or something. So in terms of resident students, we receive about, depending how you count it, $3,000 or $4,000 per student from the state, and we receive about $6,500 in tuition from the student. So that's a gap. There's it's $10,000 roughly compared to that $12,000 or $13,000. The difference actually has been coming from non-resident students, and I have a graphic in my larger presentation, excuse me, that actually shows that 15% of the costs, on average, are borne by non-resident students in the system today.
Rep. Bernick.
Mr. Chair, this may not be the time for this question, so please let me know. But
is there bad OHS here?
No. Oh, yeah. We are going to be dealing with university governance as we go along, and I suspect they'll be back. But if you could just generally talk about how the strategic planning process has gone for the state system, I'm worried about voting for changes in governance without some sense of where the changes in government fits into where you all or we all see the university system going in the future. Where are we in terms of the whole question of strategic planning and what our perception is of where the state system is going to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Is it too early to ask that question?
It's not too early to ask the question, but I think it's going to probably require more time than we have to answer it. But if you could all be thinking about that, because I think it's absolutely right that that's, we're actually going to have our first hearing on the university governance bill a week from today. And it will be, just a first stab at what's going to be a whole series of hearings. And I do like the idea of framing it up in terms of that overall strategic plan and how are, the governance changes that we're looking at in accord with that vision. I mean, we want them to further the vision.
I'm happy just to put that on the agenda.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
It's a marker.
Great. Rip, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for being here. And I, too, want to pick on Mr. Kenton. Yeah. Just give me a little more information. It doesn't have to be that precise, but you used a phrase in regard to faculty salaries that Oregon's faculty lags their peers. Can you say just a bit more about how we fit in nationally or some other aspect of that?
Chairman Denver, I'm saying, Gillian, we compile statistics on this annually, and it depends whether you look at total compensation, i.e. salaries plus the benefits, or whether you just look at the salary only. And I think it's most appropriate to look at total compensation, frankly. And each institution has a set of comparator institutions it compares itself. OSU compares itself to land-grant institutions. U of O compares itself to AAU institutions, Portland State to metropolitan institutions, etc. And I would say, the ranges vary, but we're in the mid-80s to mid-90 percentiles in total compensation compared to those peer institutions. And why that's important is we recruit faculty from a national, if not international, marketplace. And many of the best faculty have multiple institutions that would like them to work for them. So it's kind of a competitive marketplace in many ways.
Quick follow-up.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you for that answer. And I just wanted to say I was impressed with the breadth of your experience, passion for teaching. Could you repeat where you were teaching? I think it was at Portland State.
Portland State, that's correct.
But it was a
It was
the Hatfield School.
Yeah, in the Hatfield School of Government in the Masters of Public Administration.
It was the Hatfield School of Portland State.
Thank you.
It was not the Jason Lee School, was it? Sorry, little inside joke. Rep. Liston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Keaton, Vice Chancellor Keaton, thank you for putting on the record today that OUS supports the governor's PERS reforms. We came to this building of a lot of guidance from our school districts and superintendents of how PERS is affecting the number of students in class days, so thank you for doing that. Second, Vice Chancellor Rose, just a yes or no, or yes, or I'm sure that OUS system is looking into campus safety, or you're putting that on your front burner attention right now with all that's happened in the world today.
Yes. Thank you for the question, Representative Chair.
And Representative, we will be having a hearing on that issue. And I think there's some legislation we'll be looking at.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rep. Greenlick, and then we have to move on.
I'd just like to follow up on that PERS question. You really stress total compensation, which means PERS. If we reduce the value of PERS as a part of the total compensation package, will that drop those numbers significantly lower, or would it get us back to asking what's just the salary component of that, and how do we, especially when we compare salaries, are very much lower than the percentages you gave.
Chairman Dimmer, Representative Greenlick, I'd have to refresh my memory on exactly how those total comp numbers are calculated, but I do believe it's based on a cost, and as the PERS costs were to be held, constant or decrease, it may decrease that total comp. I'd have to look at it. We actually use the AAUP National, it's an annual survey called the Economic Status of the Profession Report that does a lot of those national comparators for us, and they actually have the cost of benefits in that report. And that's, so I'd have to refresh my memory on exactly how they calculate, but I believe that's roughly true. I mean, from a faculty perspective, however, it's the benefit that matters, not necessarily the cost, right? And it's the benefit at the end of the day when you do retire that really they're comparing to what another institution would offer them.
Well, let me just briefly. That means if we restrict the future COLAs, that would reduce the value of that benefit.
Chairman Dembro, Representative Greenlick, you're probably correct in that statement.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for those questions and points. Obviously, PERS is a subject for another day, and it will be a subject. Thank you all three for coming before us. I know you'll be coming back, and we look forward to that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on Oregon University System, State Board of Higher Education. And I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2787 for the purpose of adopting amendments. Colleagues, we're not going to be able to vote on the base bill today. We don't have the necessary paperwork.
Actually, we do. Just came in.
Okay. I guess we will be able to.
Oh, good.
If that is your desire.
But I'd like us initially to be talking about amendments. And just to kind of give some background to that, and when we had our hearing on Wednesday, there was a sense that there was an interest in amendments to the bill, and a group of amendments have been developed as a result of that I think, if I'm not mistaken, have been consolidated into the dash 6 version of the amendments, and I would like us to go through those. Once I saw all those, I struggled to to see, you know, how we could accommodate the concerns that were expressed in them. And let me just back up, and you know, those who are proposing these amendments can speak to their own motivation for them. But my sense is that, you know, we had great testimony on Wednesday. You saw a number of students, you heard from a number of students who would be positively affected by this legislation. And my sense is that you were impressed with them. And you wanted to make sure that these are the students who are going to benefit from tuition equity, but felt that there was perhaps some looseness in the language that you know, might cause unintended consequences to this legislation, and they would not be going to help students like these and to enhance Oregon's economic development. Other states have handled some of, you know, as I told you on Wednesday, the language of these bills, of this bill, is largely modeled after legislation that's passed in the other 12, 13 states. And those states have handled some of the details through rule. The sense I got was that there's a desire to have some of these things spelled out in statute. And so that's what I see as being reflected in the dash sixes. Anybody want to speak to that? Does that sort of capture the motivation? Rep Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As one of the individuals who is actively working, has actively worked on the dash six amendments, it seems to me, I think there's multiple categories or groups of opinion about the bill as it currently exists, about House Bill 2787. There are those, obviously, who feel very, very positive about what the bill says, what it would do in its current form. I think there are those who are strongly opposed and would not want to see it amended in any fashion, and that's fine as well. And I think there are some others who would like to see more clarity about what the bill amended, so that the bill is a little more clear about what it would do and what it would not do. And I think it's out of that motivation that I have been involved trying to provide some clarity about the tenor, about the what exactly the bill would entail and the benefits and so forth, just as an enlightening function, if you will, to try to dispel some fears, but also to ensure that some other fears are addressed as well. So that, I think, sums up my motivation for getting involved, and I think some other members, too, in trying to make this a better bill that can perhaps generate a greater breadth of approval. I'd be happy to walk through, Roy, in the point. Would you like a motion, Mr. Chair?
Why don't we just walk through them initially? And I thought what would be useful would be if we could walk through the points, and then we also have dash nines and tens, which were my best effort to address those concerns. And so perhaps we could go through them point by point and see the difference between the versions.
So you'd like me to lead?
That would be great. Is that okay, colleagues?
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Great.
Does everybody have a copy of the dash six in front of them?
You do at the bottom of your packet there.
Yeah. I have additional copies here if you need them.
They're there.
I do. I'll just kind of begin at the top and go down and highlight on certain lines things that are different in the amended version versus the original version of House Bill 2787. Line 5 calls for the applicant submitting a notarized copy of the student's application to become a citizen of the United States, or an official copy of the student's application to register with a federal immigration program or federal deportation deferral program. And that would be a reference to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That was the executive order issued last August 15th, I believe, and so forth. The point being that for those students or those individuals who would apply for that, in the eyes of the feds at this point in time, they have a legal ability to be here, and that would be automatically would clear the way for receiving in-state tuition as well. So it's kind of an either-or. moving on down to B, under line 9 of the amendment, evidence that the student has applied for and acquired a federal individual taxpayer identification number or other official federal identification document. This would be an affirmation or a reaffirmation that these students who would be able to take advantage of the program upon graduation from their institution would be able to be taxpaying citizens. It would contribute to the health and welfare of the state, and that they could be engaging in commerce and workplace relationships and so forth to be citizens of good standing, helping to provide for the welfare of the state, as I said.
Okay, let me just stop you there. Mm-hmm. And so those amendments all have to do with the issue of the affidavit that the student needs to provide to the university to show that, you know, I think the concern is, you know, we want to make sure that this is not going to individuals who are just visiting the country or who have no intention of staying in the country. Now, you know, I believe that every one of these students, if not virtually everyone, does want to become a citizen of this country, and so, you know, I think that's what the affidavit was intended to do. But there have been we heard it in 2011, and we still hear some concerns about the specificity of this affidavit. So I think that those are legitimate concerns, and if you look at the Dash 10 amendments, you'll see that I think I've largely accommodated the concerns there. It says that, you know, the D is exactly the same, shows intention to become a citizen or a lawful permanent resident of the United States by submitting to the public university the student attends or plans to attend, and then A, an official copy of the student's application to register with the Federal Immigration Program or Federal Deportation Deferral Program, taking the language from the Dash 6s, and then, or a statement of intent that the student will seek to obtain citizenship as permitted under federal law. And then also included the element of the federal ID number, an affidavit stating that the student has applied for a federal individual taxpayer identification number. That, you know, I do appreciate the Dash 6s or other official federal identification document, because it may be that someday that program changes. Right. So, you know, we may ultimately need to want to make that change. It didn't get into the Dash 10s, but we may want to. So I think we've largely come to an agreement on that one. Okay, so why don't you proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you'll turn to page 2 of the bill, line 3.
Going back to, the Dash 6.
The Dash 6, pardon me. Line 3 would be sub 4. A student who has resided outside of Oregon for more than 3 years while serving in the Armed Forces of the United States, but who otherwise meets the requirements of subsection 1 or 2 of this section, shall qualify for exemption from non-resident tuition and fees for enrollment in the public university listed without having to reestablish residency in Oregon. And this point gets to the concern that perhaps we would have high school graduates who would satisfy the requirements to graduate from high school. They may enlist in the armed forces. They may be deployed or relocated outside of the state of Oregon for a period of time greater than 3 years. Upon returning, we would not want them to have to satisfy the three-year residency requirements to simply enter our institution of higher ed. So this amendment is focused on that potential issue.
Yes, Rep. Goldman. Does a person in the Armed Forces lose Oregon residence?
I think it's possible. This is just something to make sure that if, in fact, that situation there, that they're covered.
I suppose they could change their, where they vote, where they, yeah.
As someone who has a son who is actually in the military, yes, when they establish residency in another state, they lose their military here. They have to.
Right.
If you're deployed for multiple years or period of time, and I'm sure Rep. Wisnett could comment on that as well.
Yeah, but he was from North Carolina, so it really didn't matter.
Foreign country anyway.
Rep. Parker.
I think the other issue that's being dealt with in here is the question of 3 years, because we've got a within 3 years section of the bill.
Correct.
So these folks may be
providing protection.
Even if they were to keep their retain their residency here, it might be more than 3 years out.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Rep. Parker.
Thank you. A constituent called this superfluous, and it might be. You know, somebody has to get a green card to go into the military, and if it's their choice to change residency, then, you know, sometimes they pay the cost of that choice. To come back, they'd have to spend a year here and reestablish residency. It's probably not necessary to the amendment, but I don't think it hurts it either. I think it's somewhat moot.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. You know, what initially drove this amendment, I think, was the situation of a student who was a non-U.S. citizen who went into the military. And we did get confirmation that they would, under the way the program was working, they would actually establish lawful residency through their service in the military. And so there was a feeling that they were covered. But, you know, for me, the more I thought about it, the more I realized that there are potentially U.S.-born citizens as well as people who've acquired citizenship through their service who are not being treated fairly in this bill. That is, if they join the military and then are based in another place, they may well be within the three-year period that we've said is, you know, we want to make sure that every Oregon kid who goes through Oregon schools, graduates from an Oregon high school, can be considered in-state for purposes of tuition. That philosophy applies to all Oregonians, and so let's make that clear in this bill. So I'm very pleased with that, yes.
In the Veterans Committee, for whatever reason, we do actually have two bills that we'll be looking at in the near future that are along the same lines. Mm-hmm. Again, for whatever reason, and I know that Mark Sansusi from Federal VA has come in to testify, and he will be back in to testify on behalf of at least one of those bills.
Great. And I know at least one of them deals with the spouses and dependents of service people. Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, House Bill 2787 doesn't call for it or infer it, but there can be and is a concern that in addition to offering in-state tuition, that the OUS system could conceivably lower the bar for admission for these individuals, or could create some other sort of special exemption and so forth. So with that in mind, beginning on line 9-5 says, a public university listed in ORS 352-002 may not grant admission status to a student exempted under this section that is greater than the admission status granted to Oregon residents who are citizens or lawful permanent residents of the United States. So, again, I think it states the obvious. It doesn't make a point that necessarily needs to be addressed that's in 2787, but I do think it would help to alleviate the potential concern that some individuals may have about what the bill could do.
Thank you, Rep. Johnson. And
that question about that?
Sure. Rep. Greenman.
I just want to understand what you're proposing. I mean, if the University of Oregon decided it wanted to give extra admission status to somebody of Thai ancestry, say, and it gave it to citizens of Oregon of Thai ancestry, it would be okay to give it to people under this bill. Is that how that would work?
If they'd be residents and so forth, I think they could do what they chose to, legal residents, they could do what they chose to do. But if they're
they don't have the documentation status, they can't create a special exemption just to be able to.
But they could use a special exemption that was available to residents, is what I was asking.
They're residents, I think that's they can deal with them as they choose to. Correct?
Let's say the universe orbit decides everybody over 7'2" can.
They could probably do that.
Get admitted. Correct. Now, we have a non-resident.
This is only refers to the students who are in view in the original bill.
Okay, if we could return from the world of hypotheticals.
Can I make a quick comment?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I view this mainly as an academic bar. And in my conversations with particularly Latino students that would be more than likely eligible under 2787, it was clear to me, they said, we don't want any special consideration academically. We don't want an exemption if the academic requirement for everybody is a minimum 3.0 and we have a 2.7, we don't want an exception. It was, I think, a pride issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Puffman. And I do think that all of our conversation around this bill does underscore that attitude and philosophy, that this is an area where I cannot support including this in the statute, though, just because I think it just sets us up for all sorts of unintended consequences. You know, the language admission status is pretty vague. I mean, it's very vague. And you know, I think, again, this is something that can be addressed in rulemaking, you know, if there need to be restrictions. But I think, you know, the world knows that what we are talking about here is, you know, we're not talking about special privileges for these students via this bill. What we're talking about is just simply equal treatment for tuition purposes. So, the next one, Dr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving down to line 13, sub 6, subsections 1 to 5 of the section apply only to students who are residents of the United States on the effective date of this 2013 Act. This portion would be born out of the attitude that as a state, and that as a state in this sense, we're saying that yes, we'll take ownership and provide this privilege to individuals who are residents of the United States as of the passage of the bill, recognizing that we still have a federal issue with border security and so forth. So anyone who would enter the states in a non-legal fashion after the passage of the bill would not be eligible for the privileges extended in this document. So that's what this would address, Mr. Chair. And I would say, and just make the point too, that in regards to the DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, there is a date certain in that privilege extended, saying that it applies to residents of the United States as of, I think, August 15th of 2012. So anyone who's come into the states in a non-legal fashion since that date is not eligible for the deferred action of childhood arrivals as well. So I felt that this would help to put 2787 in the same line or same vein in terms of a date certain as the federal proclamation.
Thanks, Rep. Johnson. I appreciate your position on that and your motivation. This is another one that, you know, I don't think belongs in the final bill. And the reason for that is the Deferred Action Program is an executive order, and it can be changed, you know, at a moment's notice. Well, it probably takes more than a moment, but through a relatively expedient process.
Mr. Chair, are you have comments on the... that, or is that...
Yeah, let me just finish my thought. Thanks, Representative. But, you know, there is a high likelihood, I think, that in the next couple of years or so, we're going to get some kind of immigration reform that will not simply be an amnesty. I mean, I think we've heard pretty clearly there's a lot of sentiment against blanket amnesty, but rather pathways for creating a path to citizenship. And, you know, essentially what I see being proposed here is an amnesty program. And I just don't want us to be thinking in those terms. This is not, we're not going to solve the immigration problem of the United States through this bill. So I don't think it has a place in the bill. Rep. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for interrupting. In support of adding paragraphs 5 and 6, I think that's important. I think it was stated, as you said, and I think it's sort of like paragraph 4, which affects something that's dear to my heart, but I think it's just saying the obvious that we've talked about. And also, the summary of revenue impact that we received today, I find it very interesting that the OUS system has, you know, come up with some numbers, which I think is a lot of people concerned about this legislation would have been interested in that. And I do find it, unusual, however, that Department of Revenue says there's no anticipated additional staff or faculty, but in 2003, when this bill was introduced, there was a $1.6 million financial impact, and in 2005, there was a $1.9 million financial impact. So I think addition of 5 and 6 would be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your point. Just to the issue of the the fiscal impact, the big difference between 2005 and today, of course, is that we have been able to see the experience of tuition equity playing out in those other states that have it. And it, you know, if you'll read the analysis, it does say that OUS looked at the experiences of Washington, Kansas, New Mexico, Texas, and Wisconsin, who have implemented similar programs, to estimate the number of additional students, et cetera. So, and that's that. There were a lot of concerns and fears in 10 years ago that have not played out, over the experience.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Rep. Huffman.
Are we going to have anybody that can explain the numbers? And the reason I ask is we heard from university presidents the other day that said there would be virtually no impact on the institution. And mm-hmm. granted, $335,000 spread amongst seven universities and whatnot is going to end up being a pretty small number.
This is revenue we're talking
about. It's a net revenue increase.
Oh, okay. That's right. It doesn't have the...
Right.
Yeah. Well, you should see anything like that.
No, I'm not. Not out of this.
So. Okay. Yes, Rep. Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To the amendments again.
Yes, back to the amendments. I just wanted to make the comment that I appreciate your comment about the fact that the President could change an executive order. But I have the same thought about... when we use the phrase, and when I say we in committee, not just this committee, when we use the phrase, we can always change that by administrative rule. So I think I have the same concern, but for both issues. And the last comment I would make is, when we talk about estimates as low as they are, when we talk about not anticipating a volume of students, my question is, why don't we have a cap or a sunset? If in fact that's what we feel, instead of leaving it to, oops, in 2 years it's much bigger number that we need to review or know about, why don't we put a sunset or a cap? Those are my comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Rep. Gilliam. Well, actually, that kind of takes us to our last point. And Rep. Johnson, could you talk about the reporting?
Sure. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The last point that's encapsulated in dash 6 is would attempt to address the concerns that have been brought up that the system would have a large influx of students, or that their costs would be exorbitant, or perhaps that it would just be other undesirable consequences. And it simply says that no later than July 1st of each year, the OUS system shall report to the Legislative Assembly for the preceding academic year on A, the number of students that applied and were accepted into public universities under this section, and B, the financial impact of this section on OUS. So it's simply a reporting mechanism, but it makes sure that the legislature will have a regular update and reporting on just what is the impact exactly, so that we could modify and take action if necessary to alleviate that. We asked the presidents when they were testifying on Wednesday about that, and they all thought that would not be an issue. And I think our OUS system could certainly report on that, in addition to all the other many things they give us updates on. So that's the intent and that part of the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Johnson. I fully agree with that. And the only change that I made in the dash 10s was to rather than the report go out to the entire legislature, I have it going to the to the presiding officers, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the President of the Senate, and then the interim appropriate interim education committees. And then, you know, through them, it can go out to the larger body. Okay. So I think those are all of the amendments. If colleagues, if you'll indulge me, I'm going to go stand down for a moment, okay, before we proceed. Okay, we're back in session. Just a reminder, we're still in a work session, and initially for the purpose of adopting amendments. Representative Huffman.
Chair Dembrow, I move to adopt the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2787.
Rep. Huffman has moved the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2787. Discussion. Hearing none. Cassie, would you call the roll on the Dash 6 amendments?
Representative Mayhew.
I should have asked the question what that means. Does that mean adopting all of the Dash 6 amendments or certain ones of them?
No. So these amendments are packaged in different, so there's the Dash 6 and the Dash 10 that we went over. Right. These are the Dash 6 amendments.
I don't know that.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch?
No.
Representative Brindley?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Woodman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
No.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Aye.
Chair Dembrow?
No. The motion fails. Rep. Huffman? Rep. Harker?
Chair, I would like to propose that we adopt the Dash 10 amendments to House Bill 2787, as just discussed.
Thank you. Rep. Harker has moved the Dash 10 amendments to House Bill 2787. Any discussion? Hearing none, Cassie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Gallegos?
Yes.
Representative
Gilliam? No.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Greenland?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Woodman?
No.
Vice Chair Harker?
Yes.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Aye.
Chair Dembrow?
Aye. The amendments are adopted. Do I have to call another work session?
Close
out. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2787, which was for the purpose of adopting amendments. And I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2787. Can I have a motion, please?
What are we doing?
A motion.
We can't move the bill without a fiscal. We don't have a fiscal on the amendments.
Oh, I thought you said we did.
No,
we
have
the revenue, but not the
fiscal.
That
is on the underlying.
On the revenue side.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2787. We'll be carrying it over till Monday. We are waiting for the legislative fiscal analysis on the amendments that we just adopted.
Mm. Okay. So we need a work session to do
the committee. Do we
have a committee for it? Yeah. Sure, can I ask a question?
Yes, yeah, sure.
I think I understand the red tape after 12 years. The fiscal impact, we have what is proposed as a fiscal impact statement.
Yes, on the base bill, the unamended bill is what we have.
Ah,
and they
yes,
need to
I'm
see
sorry,
that,
I remember.
You know, I think that our assumption is that, that these amendments don't bring added fiscal impact, but we need to make sure of that before we vote, because we can't send a bill to the floor where we haven't considered its fiscal impact. So I am going to open a work session now for the purpose of introducing committee bills. We have a committee bill before us. It's LC 3591. It has to do with developing an associate transfer degree of engineering. So I actually have a clip for that one. Rep. Parker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Chair Dembrow, I would move that we, that LC 3591 dated January 30th, 2013, introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, Rep. Parker has moved that legislative concept 3591, dated January 30th, 2013, be introduced as a committee bill. Colleagues, any discussion? Yes, Rep. Gillian.
Would you mind, for those of us that are school learners, just give me the snapshot again? I don't have it.
Okay. And let me just say, this is just introducing it as a committee bill. This shows no indication of how we feel about it.
Absolutely.
Yes. Any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, any objections to this being introduced as a committee bill? All right. LC 3591 will be introduced as a committee bill. Okay, now I will open a public hearing on House Bill, whatever it is.
2152.
Welcome. Okay. Victoria, can you please tell us what this is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2152 requires the State Board of Higher Education and Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to conduct annual reviews of public universities and community colleges, respectively, regarding staffing to student ratios, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, let me just give you a quick background to this. This is a bill that actually was introduced in the 2012 session, or the concept was introduced in that session. And what it does is it builds on a process that began in 2009 with House Bill 2557, which requires the universities and community colleges to annually report on the number of full-time versus part-time faculty that they have at each of their institutions. This is part of a package called the Faculty and College Excellence Act. And they have reported on an annual basis since then. Now, there has been a desire to, while there's been appreciation of getting that information, there's also a desire to see the larger pattern of staffing at our public colleges and universities with respect to the non-teaching staff and including management staff. And so what this bill does is it asks for that to be reported annually to us so we can start having baselines. I will just say, in way of further introduction, I feel like we hear every day that part of the reason for the rise in cost of higher education is that too much money is going into management or is going into employment outside the classroom. And I think we need to have a better sense of that. Is that true? Is it urban myth? Is that helping to drive up the cost? With that, we have some panels to respond to that issue. Let me just say, as way of final introduction, that my intention is, after we hear the whys of this, I mean, why should we have this bill, and then I think we'll also have some concerns about the bill, my intention is to convene a work group to work through some of the challenges that the institutions might have in complying with it and try to come to some sort of agreement and then bring the bill back to you for a work session. So, with that, I'd like to call up our first panel, and that would be Patricia Schechter and David Reeves and Jim Salt. Let's start with our esteemed faculty. And the three of you, welcome. Choose your own lead-off speaker.
I'll go after David. Thank you,
Chair. You're going to have to make a decision.
I drew the short straw. Good morning, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is David Reeves. I'm president of American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. I'm also been a longtime teacher at Portland Community College. Just a little intro. The American Federation of Teachers, Oregon represents 15,000 members across the state. Our members work in elementary and high schools, community colleges, four-year colleges and universities, health care clinics and hospitals. We are a union of professionals, AFT. Our members include faculty, professors, graduate employees, professional and support staff, early educators, and healthcare professionals. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2152. This would require both the State Board of Higher Education and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to study staff-to-student ratios. And I think it's important in any discussion of post-secondary education, we recognize the diverse missions in post-secondary education. And these missions, these priorities are reflected in the individual missions of the institutions, of the colleges and universities. And these can be any combination in our colleges and universities of instruction, lifelong learning, degrees, certificates, community service, workforce development, developmental education, and research. But I think we all agree that certainly instruction, degrees, and certificates are a major component of any college or university's mission. And it's also a focus of the state's 40-40-20 goals now for degrees and certificates throughout post-secondary education and more student success and completion. And I think we do need to see some reporting on the ratios of our staff to students, especially in these times where we're seeing barriers to student success and completion. Booming enrollment, continued disinvestment in our education system, more of the cost burden being shifted to the institutions and particularly to the students, and the stresses we're seeing on the system with overfilled classes, lack of access to classes due to those factors. I think it's real important if we want to help improve what we're doing in the universities and colleges around the state, we have to know what the current staff to student ratios are at our institutions. As the chair mentioned, this isn't the first time this legislature has addressed student staff ratios. We did that with House Bill 2257 that looked at the amount of full-time faculty compared to contingent faculty in our colleges and universities. And the Vice Chancellor mentioned some figures about the increase in contingent faculty from 20% to currently a third of the teachers at the universities in Oregon. And these statistics have been very important. I would beg to differ that all the contingent faculty, part-time adjunct faculty in our institutions are just the more specialized. I know, for instance, at Portland Community College, the largest community college in the state, the majority of classes in English, math, what you would call college transfer courses, the basic 101, 102, 103 courses are taught by adjunct instructors. These aren't just moonlighting people. These are instructors trying to make a full profession out of basically what are temporary and part-time assignments. And I think the data we're getting out of that about the amount of contingent faculty, adjunct faculty we're having teach will really help us look at what are the keys to student success and completion. I know myself as an adjunct that the poor working conditions for contingent faculty, there's so little time devoted to anything outside of just strictly classroom instruction. Things like curriculum development, institutional involvement, engagement with colleagues, and most importantly, just the time devoted to students out of the class. Student conferences, that advising, mentoring, coaching of students. I think this, and the research shows actually that this has a direct effect on how many students succeed, particularly the most vulnerable, the most underserved of our students. So I think this is a good benefit of House Bill 2257 as we're moving forward and looking at just who we're employing and their working conditions in our universities and colleges and their relationship with students and how much services and instruction students receive. I'd also like to mention the Oregon Education Investment Board is setting up a longitudinal database to look at learners from early childhood, some are even saying from birth, through lifelong learning. And I think it's very important as we're going forward, as the chair said, there's some urban myths, there's some anecdotal, there's some research, that we really collect data that's valuable to what points to student success, what points to increased completion, and we really look at it as evidence and find the patterns that emerge. And I think this House Bill 2152 will add to that. I think it's very important that we have some data, and there is some of this data is certainly lacking in post-secondary education. I think everybody in the education community would agree with that. So to conclude, I'd say our faculty in our universities and colleges, both full-time and contingent, professional and support staff, those on the front lines in the classroom, front lines of education, see the everyday impact that instruction and other services have on students. And knowing more about the ratios of how many teachers, professors, instructors, support staff are serving students will help us look more at what's the most effective way to achieve student success in higher education. House Bill 2152 is the next step in this kind of reporting. Those who teach students and support student services in our schools and colleges know that a transparent, collaborative process is a key to implementing improvements in the education system, and I urge you to support 2152 to that effect. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Of course, you had a question.
Yeah, a couple of different things. Number one, in terms of teacher ratios to supervisory ratios, where's the line drawn between those two groups? Is it starting at the dean level and up, and then instructors below that, or I think it's an important distinction.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That is a very good question, yeah. And I don't think it's that clear of a line, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I think hopefully the data will take that into account. It won't just be too simple. Job categories,
right.
And I think you're making a very important point there. We do have to look at that.
Well, and I'm concerned that if we do make a distinction like that, which is really easy to do, that we'll miss the point that some supervisory personnel are extremely important to instruction. And the line deans are just as important in my mind as the instructors, because without the line deans that are there to help the instructors offer the service. For instance, at my college, at Mount Hood, we have a serious problem with that, where we've had multiple departments put under a single dean, and they're just not able to have the time to help with instruction. So that's why I'm worried about that.
Well, this bill is just to collect reporting data. It's not to implicate...
So let me just jump in here, because we don't have a lot of time.
Sorry.
But just to clarify, as I mentioned before, Rep. Gorsuch, my intention is, after today's meeting, to set up a work group that will look at those questions.
Okay.
We want data that's good data, that's meaningful. We don't want just arbitrary categories. We want things that will inform us, in knowing how the institutions are doing. So, I'm sensing that you want to be part of this work group.
Oh, good.
And it
may
be
excellent.
I also want to point out that as a department chair, I always believe the fewer deans, the better.
We don't have department chairs.
Yeah.
And when I talked about the diverse missions in post-secondary, I think that should take that into account.
And if I could just do one quick follow-up.
Okay, real quick follow-up, because I'd really rather have the questions go to the entire panel. But
The other issue, though, is that when you were talking about the part-time, full-time, it's not just time, though, and I don't think the numbers get at the fact that there are certain institutional problems where, for instance, teachers that are part-time are not considered to be full-fledged members of the group, and so they're not encouraged to advise students and be involved with students. I mean, that's another problem with that data.
That's the working conditions I was talking about.
Okay, Mr. Salt, why don't we go on?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. My name is Dr. James Salt, and I'm president of the OEA Community College Council. It represents roughly 4,000 faculty and staff members across the state at the community colleges. I'm also a sociology instructor at Lane Community College, and I was formerly a visiting assistant professor at Lewis and Clark College and briefly at Linfield. I also taught at the University of Oregon, where I earned my doctorate. And given that, I have some sense, I think, of the state of education in the state of Oregon. But ironically, I don't think the state of Oregon has a sense of the kind of issues and data that my colleague here just spoke to, because we don't collect it. To take an earlier example, it was stated that at the university, perhaps it's the case there, that the primary difference in cost is between full-time and part-time faculty is because of different benefits. But at the community colleges, also very different pay levels. We use a different pay schedule there, unlike at the K-12 schools, where you get paid based upon your FTE. Part-time faculty are paid at much lower rates. But how much? We don't know, because again, the state doesn't collect the data. This bill would address that. It isn't, of course, solely about compensation. It's also about a number of things I'll talk about too. One is access, and the other is success. Access to faculty, as David earlier suggested, is restricted when a college or university relies overly on part-time faculty. It's not that the part-time faculty don't want to be available. In some cases, it's not even part of their job description. They're not paid to hold office hours. But the bigger obstacle is that many of them are trying to construct a full-time job. Most part-time faculty at the community colleges in Oregon are involuntarily part-time. So they cobble together different jobs. Some of you may have heard the term Rhodes Scholar, R-O-A-D, right? Scholar, because the time spent traveling from one job to another. That doesn't just impact the faculty, it impacts students and their ability to contact them. And as David also suggested, there is research to show that the access to faculty and the hindrance to that is a hindrance to completion and success rates for students. It's also an issue for having faculty available and staff available to participate in the many initiatives that we're facing across the state. Some of them coming from the national level, some of them come from the state, some of them local and internal. At Lane, we have so many projects we're working on right now, you can't even track them. How are we going to succeed in reforming education and getting the faculty and staff engaged in that work when faculty many of them aren't available to participate in that because their part-time faculty is not part of their assignment, they aren't compensated for doing so, they're on the road, etc. Again, they want to participate. We need to be able to assess the reliance upon part-time faculty and their ability to engage in such work so that we can ensure that education succeeds in Oregon. My final point is that some would argue that it's too hard or too costly to collect this data. And I'm sorry, but that's just not true. Because in some ways, we already are collecting the data. It just isn't the state. The primary source of data on community college compensation-related issues, salaries, insurance, et cetera, is collected by the OEA in an almanac. I meant to stop at the office and pick one up. I didn't have time this morning, given your early start. It's about this thick, and it's collected annually. And the work is done as a side project by one staff member at OEA with a little bit of support of one secretary working with HR departments across the state. Right? We provide copies to HR, and that's their primary source of access, primary source of information on that. The problem, of course, is that it isn't collected by the state. We can't be sure that it's all using the exact same methodology, that the data are operationalized in the same way. We can't get into some of the nuances that Representative Gorsuch asked about, because it's a project that the OEA engages in. These data ought to be collected at the state level. The OEA Community College Council strongly supports this bill. We urge your support as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Salt. Ms. Schechter, and let me say, in, before you speak, I agree with much of what the previous speakers had to say, but I agree with everything that you will have to say, and I say that because you are my constituent. And I know that everything you have to say will be relevant and brilliant. So,
Mr. Chair, I need to apologize. I'm double booked, and I need to run out. I'm sorry I'm going to miss your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dembo, and members of this committee for hearing us today. For the record, my name is Patricia Schechter. I am the chairperson of the Legislative Committee of the American Association of University Professors at Portland State University. We represent full-time faculty at PSU, and I'll just say a sentence about AAUP. Jay Kenton mentioned this organization in his remarks this morning. And AAUP, founded in 1915, is the historic organization that has advanced and led the professoriate in the United States for now almost a century, and it defends excellence and academic freedom, which serve as the distinguished hallmarks of higher ed in this country. I'll also say that I am one of the fortunate ones. I've been 18 years in rank at Portland State. I just achieved full professor about a year ago, and aside from raising a husband and two children, teaching is my love. Is my love, is my passion, and my life's work. Fun fact about me is that I'm actually I teach U.S. history, and I'm an informal student, I guess, of the Oregon legislature. I had the honor of working with Avo Gordley over the past few years to organize her personal archives at Portland State University and help her get a memoir out, which has been the best-selling book that OSU Press has had, and it's the biggest rollout ever when it came out in 2011. So I have a very keen and deep appreciation for the work that goes on in this chamber and the other chambers in Salem, and really want to thank you all for the hard work that you do for the state in the issue of higher education. As many of you probably know, something called administrative bloat is making headline news where higher ed is concerned. It figures in a national discussion about how to keep student learning at the center of education in these tough economic times. In December, the Wall Street Journal cited U.S. Department of Education figures showing that employees hired by colleges and universities to manage or administer people and programs increased 50% faster than the number of instructors between 2001 and 2011. And this December article put the state of Oregon in the spotlight on this very issue. So I'm here to tell you how pleased I am that HB 2152 puts the focus right where it belongs, on the staffing to student ratio. This focus is crucial because classrooms are the critical location where value added for public and tuition dollars really happens. Students and the public deserve the accountability that this bill promises. The power of this bill is its focus on a key theme that I've heard the chair voice early in this session concerning higher ed. That is the importance of investing in human infrastructure for the success of our educational system. By carefully tracking the ratio of instruction to various faculty categories, the review process outlined in HB 2152 promises to help direct resources so they yield the highest return to students. As my Portland State colleague Rob Fulmer will testify a little later with the numbers, the really hard numbers, the faculty to student ratio trend line at Portland State is downward and worrisome and indicates a thinning of faculty contact with students. Figures from the OUS Factbook and Human Resources prepared by AAUP suggest that the best supported faculty, as my colleagues have testified, the best supported faculty, that even the tenure-related faculty, have very much slipped in their place in the instructional mix on campus. Between 2002 and 2012, student enrollment increased about 24% at PSU, but tenure-related hires increased only by 18.5%. The professional literature confirms that faculty to student ratios remain key indicators of quality and student success in higher education. One study, this is from Europe and in England, still finds that in 2011, quote, smaller class sizes lead to higher academic learning progress, better knowledge of students, and better classroom processes. Closer to home, in 2012, another study at the University of California stressed, quote, the benefits for reducing class size for student grades across all disciplines, and that the effect of increasing class size is more pronounced in engineering, biology, and social science. So as I think has been indicated, certain disciplines are more sensitive to class sizes. Not one size fits all. And one of the things I was very appreciative. I'm a humanist through and through, but my colleagues in engineering, nursing, life sciences, they actually need even smaller class sizes because of the different kinds of mentoring and teaching that are really central to those fields. I can tell you from my own experience, and this again validates what Jay Kenton mentioned earlier today, that when I started teaching at Portland State in the mid-90s, my classes were booked for 25 students. Now they're booked for 60. As higher education research confirms, large class sizes can foster more creative teaching strategies. And so I do different things now. I arrange students in small group for discussion. We do peer review, student peer review of writing. I require every student to meet with me outside of class time. But students are also telling me that they are keenly aware of paying more and more money for less and less of faculty time. PSU AAUP supports the transparency and disclosure that HB 2152 requires. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify this morning, and I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you. I'm just curious about the need for this bill. I mean, it just seems to me the data is out there and it just needs to be collected and aggregated. So I'm not clear on the need for the bill. But the other thing that the presentations make me think about is, I mean, there are just a lot of variables involved other than just ratio. Teacher competence, for one thing. Just a number of other variables. And it just seems to me that if we want to know about is the success rate of students or even the cost variables, then we really need a full picture that would account for sort of all of these kinds of things.
Chair, would you give me to respond?
Please, thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative, for your question. As you'll see in my written copy of my testimony, there is a huge literature on precisely this question. And you're absolutely right. There are numerous variables that go into making a successful classroom that go determine student success. However, nobody has been able to knock out class size. It's simply part of the sociology, the human sociology of how learning happens in any society. Don't even think of class. You can think of any human educational, mentoring, parenting relationship. It simply has not been able to be eliminated as a factor. So you're right, it must be a rich stew of considerations. The other thing, there's a couple of things that keep class size as a pressure point, as an index. It's one of the figures that allow comparisons across institutions and even across countries. Class size is one of the few durable benchmarks that allow the United States to compare itself to other countries. Most of the data I looked at for this presentation was, surprise, England and the United States. I would really like to know how China thinks about class size, because they are doing some remarkable experiments in higher education there. So I totally endorse, I totally agree what you're saying. It's borne out in the literature. However, it remains a crucial benchmark for how people understand the mix that creates the value you're identifying.
Thank you, Patricia. Dr. Saul, if you could respond quickly,
and quickly.
We'll have to move on.
As a sociologist, I love data. The more data, the better. As a faculty leader interested in success, very interested in the data that you speak to. I beg to differ. I don't think the data are at least being collected in the way in which they need to be, even though my own organization is the one that's been collecting a lot of the data on this. I would recommend supporting this bill, and if there are future bills that would address collecting data more focused on student success, then let's pursue that. You'll likely see me back here supporting that as well.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, all three of you. I'd like to call up the next panel because we're running out of time here. I'd like to bring up a panel now of people who would be charged with implementing this study and who may have some concerns about it. So I'd call up Connie Green, President of Tillamook Bay Community College, John Wyckoff from the Oregon Community College Association, and although he hasn't signed up, I'm going to ask Jay Kenton to come up, please. Thank you. John, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. We represent the locally elected boards of all 17 community colleges in Oregon. I first want to start by thanking Representative Dembro for his willingness to work with all the parties that would be involved in this to make preparing this report more workable. Having said that, we have some concerns, not just about that, but about the very fact of doing this and whether this is the right direction to go. But let me start there. We are already tasked with looking at our ratios of full-time to part-time faculty and preparing a report. That in and of itself has been a difficulty. Each college may classify these differently, has different ways of looking at this, calculates these things differently, and so it is a cumbersome process just to sort of try to translate between. I think our colleges, if you ask them, would rather spend their time making sure that courses transfer from community colleges to universities rather than making sure that the classifications can be translated between college to college, because in and of itself, that doesn't move us any closer to 40-40-20. That doesn't get us any closer to the outcomes that the OAIB is going to be tasking us with achieving through achievement compacts, and I want to talk a little bit about that. This sort of carves out a narrow piece of data that we're going to look at and assumes that the answer lies there, I think, before we really ask the question, is that where the answer lies? So let me talk a little bit about that. As you add classifications and say, and we will look at management, classified staff, and compare them to student FTE, I think we really have to ask the question, is that the right question? And does that move us towards 40-40-20? I don't know that we know that it does. It seems somewhat inconsistent with the direction of the OAIB, which we've all heard the term tight loose. We're going to be tasked with tight outcomes. The state will be asking us to look at outcomes and say, we're not going to micromanage how you get there. And I think here we assume, again, that the answer will lie in our ratio of certain kinds of staff, certain kinds of employee groups to student FTE. I don't know that we know that. I very much agree with my colleagues in their testimony who said we need to look at the patterns that drive student outcome and focus on those. This assumes that the patterns will lie here. I don't know that we know that. We are looking at, the OAIB is putting together a longitudinal database so that we can look at these sorts of things. And we very much believe that we should. We have been, since 2009, we have been looking at full-time to part-time staffing ratios. And I think that the advocates for this bill very sincerely believe that this could be a tool to make the argument for appropriate funding levels. Anybody who knows what's happened with our funding since 2009, I think it's hard to make the argument that it has done that. Since the beginning of the recession, the colleges have seen their enrollment go up almost 40% in FTE enrollment. Over that time, our budget has dropped dropped about 20%, meaning that what we have to spend per student it has gone down nearly 40%. And so I would suspect that many of these staffing levels are not currently appropriate. We know that. We've been cutting access to counselors. We've been cutting access to all kinds of things because we've been trying to enroll students during the bad economy. Preparing this information isn't going to move the ball forward for college students in any of these areas, and I think that's one of our concerns here, is that what we essentially do is spend some time preparing data that has not been asked for by the OAIB or the new Higher Education Coordinating Commission to have yet another report that ends up on the shelf. We're being asked to create a lot of reports, and we're going to be asked to collect more data. But we think that should be part of a larger context. What this doesn't look at is, yes, we look at staffing ratios to student FTE, but we don't look at what's happened to the overall budget and whether that's important in the context.
John, if you could wrap up.
Sure. Anyway. I think that a question has come from this panel that, or from you all, that we need to look at the overall context here. And this is just simply a part of it. This is just one part of it, and it assumes that we will find the answer here. And I think that the answer probably lies in making sure that we are all funded well enough to be able to provide the services we need for students. The other concern, just quickly, that we would have is it sort of creates the idea that we're starting from a baseline that may be appropriate. And I think in a lot of these classifications, this may not be an appropriate baseline. And so we haven't even really done the research to know, is there an appropriate classified staffing level to student FTE? And what is that? And what should we be driving for? We should at least start there and sort of not put the cart before the horse, which is what I think this legislation does. And with that, I will close and turn it over to the president of Tillamook Bay Community College, Connie Green.
Connie, it's an honor to have you.
Well, Representative Dembrow, Chair Dembrow, members of the committee, I'm Connie Green, president of Tillamook Bay Community College, and I've had lots of other hats in my 40 years of community college work around policy or working on institutional and student success with some of you. So let me begin, first of all, with OCCA and the president do oppose the bill, but we welcome the work group. And that is really where we want to begin, is how do you welcome the work group and begin this work? We support student success. I believe Commissioner Price was here talking about the redesign and where community colleges are from American Association and kind of reclaiming the different areas. We took this report that I know some of you saw on institutional student success and actually updated the student success plan for community colleges and included that report. So we want to talk about student success. We want to talk about access, persistence, students moving, what's there. We really believe that's where we should be spending our time and energy. Completing the report that we currently do from House Bill 2557, it's different for us than it is for OUS. We don't have a central place for all this is. We have 17 different ways of doing this. It isn't as easy for Jay to push a button to get the report, but it feels like it's that easy compared to us collecting from 17. And all of our 17 agreements are different. So when we pull them in, it also has to resonate on the campus at Mount Hood, at PCC, at Tillamook Bay. It has to resonate when we send in that looks like us as well as it looks comparable. That has been hard. When we get to how we're going to add administrators and classifiers, I teach at Tillamook Bay as well as the president. So does my chief academic officer. Our librarian oversees our peer tutors. We currently are looking at more people looking at flipped classrooms, instructional assistants coming into our adult basic skills, our math emporiums, our math tutoring. They're not faculty, but they're giving us exactly what research says, some of the one-on-one support. Where do they fit? How do we put them into this? So we're in the midst of redesign, and this is in the midst of collecting something that we're not even sure how to categorize it, and is it a long different, is it multiple categories, so it's not a line? It's not about not wanting to work together on student success and how we fund these things. It's that we fund them very differently, but we work with our communities to make it work. So our discussions are really focusing on outcomes. We're supporting, really, as the interim chancellor talked about, 40-40-20 being the true North Star. Well, if we're going after that, then all of us are looking at how we do that, how we get more students persisting, more students with certificates and degrees. Doing this report as it is laid out does not seem to give us that piece. So unless we connect these better and really have a whole picture of research, not a partial picture, we need to really make it the whole picture. And if you look at a community college as small as Tillamook Bay or as large as PCC, we can't keep doing multiple reports. Somewhere we have to begin to do this stuff together. As Elaine talked about initiative fatigue, we have a lot of great things happening. We've got to get clear how they happen together and begin to pare them down to be very targeted. This bill would take us off track the way it is currently designed. We look forward to answering questions and working with the work group.
Thank you, Connie. I am going to hold questions if we can. I want to get us out of here in a few minutes. And actually, before you, Jay, I'd like to call up Rob Fulmer, if we could. So, Connie, if you and John could stand down.
Yeah.
I know Rob has traveled a long way to get here. And Amory, do you want to come up, too? And if you could be real brief. And, Jay, you can kind of respond to what they have to say as well.
Okay.
Sorry. Rob, would you introduce yourself and please?
Good morning. I
don't know if I need to speed read here this morning. I'm going to go through this as quickly as I can, though. You guys are being presented with materials that I'm going to be talking about. Good morning. My name is Rob Fulmer, and I'm a member of the Service Employees International Union, Local 503. SEIU represents about 4,000 classified workers who support students and faculty in the Oregon University system. We work in food and custodial service facilities and grounds maintenance, financial and academic offices, IT and campus libraries. I am a steward and PSU's bargaining delegate and have represented our chapter in the ongoing financial restructuring at PSU. Professionally, I work as one of two IT staff in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, serving the IT and support and planning needs of over 600 faculty and staff in the college, a capacity in which I've served since 2005. I spent my career in higher education because I believe in the mission. I view preparing our youth to be able to make contributions to our society as a fundamental responsibility. I'm here today to provide testimony in support of HB 2152 regarding the annual review of staffing ratios in public universities and community colleges. More transparency about how our institutions are investing the resources provided to them to operate will ensure they can be kept focused on spending those resources in ways that will most benefit students. First, I want to thank OUS for the information they voluntarily disclosed on manager-to-staff ratios. Unfortunately, the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, or IPEDS, metrics they used for this analysis yielded data that is at best misleading. From Table 1, which you guys have in front of you, staffing ratios, you can see that with the IPEDS categories, only 36 managers are listed for all of the University of Oregon, and only 52 for all of Portland State University. So given the data that they voluntarily disclosed, that you can see here, we're talking about ratios of like 150 to 1. If you've ever seen an organization with that kind of staffing ratio, I would love to hear it, because I don't think they exist. Obviously, the data that we're being given does not accurately reflect what's really going on. So, PECBA has a more appropriate set of guidelines to use, and it was those guidelines that were employed in HB 2020 and in HB 4131 to affect significant cost savings in reducing management bulletin state agencies since they were passed in recent sessions. And I gave Cassandra some additional materials that you guys can review at your leisure about how effective that has been. I'm not arguing higher education is the same as the state agencies to which HB 2020 applied, nor that the same 11-to-1 target ratio necessarily is appropriate for OUS. But we can't even begin to see what makes sense until we are able to get true metrics for what the real ratios are today. Last January, in legislative testimony, Mark Neisenfeld, president of PSU's chapter of SEIU, cited a study by the Goldwater Institute entitled Administrative Bloated American Universities, which indicated that from 1993 to 2007, the ratio of administrators to students increased significantly at Oregon State University and the University of Oregon, the only two institutions at Oregon that particular study looked at. As the bargaining delegate at PSU, I spent several days in the last few months reading member surveys in preparation for upcoming contract negotiations, and I noticed a huge number of longtime PSU workers bringing up workload stress issues. These are people who have been at Portland State for a very long time, and they're saying, I'm working harder now than I ever have. We're not opposed to hard work, but why are people working so much harder? Well, it made me wonder, what a change to make the workload stress issue so acute? So I used the data from the PSU fact book on the web to see what the basis of this anxiety about increased workload was about, and what I found was alarming, and that's figure one, if you guys will look at that for a second. Basically, what we found was that classified ratios, there are more students per classified than there ever have been. There are more students per faculty than there ever have been. And at Portland State, there are fewer administrators. There are actually more administrators now than there were a decade ago. So it seems to be a troubling trend. So as you can see, the trends look bad, and particularly so for staff, but they are headed in the other direction for administrators. Remember, this is using the university's own figures, admittedly for PSU only, but this information will likely look similar for other campuses since we hear similar reports from employees in those other institutions. SEIU estimated OUS staffing ratios in our holding OUS accountable document in 2011. There's a figure here. Now, obviously, these staffing ratios are much, much lower, but the reason that they're so much lower is because there are too many people in the administrative staff category. And the reason that there are so many is because we don't have accurate information for how many actual managers there are. We know that it's somewhere between the IPEDS data and this data, but we don't know what it is. And part of the purpose of 2152 is for us to get real numbers so that we can make those assessments. Until we have the real numbers, how can we make the assessments? So for the state to meet its 40-40-20 goal, OUS will need to increase enrollment further over the years ahead, and there's no reason to think that the trend we're seeing here will change without intervention. There is room for greater administrative efficiency in our universities, and requiring OUS to release realistic data on staffing ratios using a more appropriate metric, PECPA-defined standards, is a critical first step toward that goal. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Rob. That was a very cogent presentation. Emma, could you give us a very quick sense of where you are on this bill?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. My name is Emma, for the record, Emma Calloway, Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association. I won't brief you on that organization right now. So I've been trying to highlight pieces of my testimony. Just want to let you know that the Oregon Student Association is supportive of House Bill 2152. This bill will provide more information on our campus budgets that's currently unavailable to students. And we know that conversations have started on our campus about, what tuition would look like at 0%. We want to know what our budget would look like. And we believe that although we want to be reasonable about tuition increases, we also think that more data would be helpful. And we think that this is a bill that could help us get there. We want to know, who's being hired with our tuition dollars. We want to know why class sizes are going up. We want to know why tuition is skyrocketing. And we don't necessarily agree or know for sure that this bill will get us to that answer, but we know that more information is always helpful and will help to shed light on some of the confusion that we have around increased costs of our system. So thank you very much, and I will also be sending you written testimony that's clearer than what I just stated.
Well, that was excellent, Emma. Thank you. Jay, can you just give us some quick responses to what you've heard?
Chairman Demereau, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor of Finance at the Oregon University System. And I'm a little confused by some of the comments, but I do want to say I support what my community college colleagues said earlier. We have been giving you this information, I believe. We give it to you in the form of House Bill 2557 data, House Bill 4057 data from prior sessions. I agreed voluntarily, as the chair would remember, in February to provide data, which I've done. We publish this information on a regular basis, student to employee ratios, etc. I'm a little confused about the staff or span of control, because that doesn't seem to be in this bill. And if it does get in this bill, we'd be happy to provide that information as well. However, there's some nuances that I think are very important in this conversation. And let me just cite a couple of statistics. So last year, I asked my payroll people, how many paychecks did we generate? Well, the answer is 49,000 paychecks were generated from Oregon University System institutions. One half of those went to student employees. And so, somebody has to supervise them too and manage their affairs. We also give contracts for a term. We give contracts for a 9-month period of time. We give contracts for a 12-month period of time. We have people engaged in multiple activities. It's almost like a matrix management structure. I have department chairs that supervise the staff of an office. They teach classes, but then they may also manage a research project with a totally different set of staff and faculty that they're managing in that. The other thing I would point out is with distance education, students are maybe not even coming to campus as much, and you have a number of different things there. So I'm not unwilling to work with you to provide the information that you're looking for. I think there's a lot of devils in the details we just need to sort through, and we'd welcome the opportunity to work with the work group if that's where this ends up, but those would be my comments.
Okay, thank you, Jay. And, as Jay mentioned, if I neglected to say, OUS did, when House Bill 4057 had to be amended to address another need that OUS had, Jay voluntarily committed to providing us with information. What this bill would do is this would normalize it, and I hope through the work of the work group really make sure that it's getting us the information that we need so we can really assess what's going on in the staffing ranks in our colleges and universities. With that, if any of you are interested in being part of this work group, please let me know. I'm sure it will be scintillating. if not time-consuming, and a great opportunity for you.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question again, a reconfirmation. Your intent would be to pursue the a work group to focus on the issue, but not move the bill at this point in time. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Thank you all for coming. I wish we hadn't gotten so rushed at the end, but that other issue took more time than I feared. So with that, I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2152. I'm going to carry over House Bill 2787 till Monday. And we are adjourned.